So today, the topic of conversation is species are everywhere, but they don't exist. Mm. Yeah. So we're going to start super in the weeds here and then hopefully wander our way out eventually. We'll see how well that works.
There is a world beyond what you see and what you hear, beyond the comfort of your daily life, beyond the confines of ordinary reality. This world is all around you, at all times, if only you dare to look below the surface, let go of what you think you know, and join us in a world of endless wonder on the Quest Podcast. Thanks.
This is Quest Podcast number 2. I am Danan. I am a PhD student at UC Merced. I am an evolutionary ecologist, more than anything else at least.
Hi, I'm Nate Fox. I am a PhD student at UC Merced. I am a paleomammologist.
Fancy.
Or we'll just say paleontologist.
I kind of like paleomammologist.
Me too.
Nothing else matters but mammals. But
I'm Taryn Rawlings. I'm also a PhD student at UC Merced, and I study paleo food webs.
Tell me more about what you do, Taryn.
Tell us.
I study paleo food webs from a lot of different... I just do a lot of computational and quantitative stuff in paleo food webs, trying to figure out how mostly Pleistocene food webs were structured and worked.
So, species are everywhere, but they don't exist.
How did you end up with that prompt in the first place?
It seemed like a good prompt.
Yeah.
Because it is a very, I guess, sort of controversial statement, yeah. But also a statement that I think most non-biologists would be super freaked out to hear, and that most biologists would either argue over or go, yeah, that's basically right.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a good place to start this conversation, because yeah. It is really in the weeds, because it's true. Like, species are everywhere, but our definitions of what a species is are entirely for our own benefit.
Right. In my undergrad, I took a class on sustainable communities while I was working on my BA stuff, and the professor who was running this class on, you know, starting with the idea of community, had his little similar tagline prompt about communities that I think applies, communities not ecological communities, but like human communities, that I think applies in the same way. And he said that the closer you get to community, the harder it is to find. And I find that's totally the same problem that I have with species concepts, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Is that in the broad strokes, when you're thinking about, yeah, I know what a species is, that's fine. You know, looking at it from a distance, and then the closer you get to it, the more fluidity you see shows up in it, and the harder it is to actually parse out, you know, what do we mean when we're talking about species. And certainly, I think, as you were describing, with non-biologists hearing about this difficulty and finding that unsettling. When I first confronted this difficulty, it really, really fucking bothered me. Like, how can this not be a thing?
It's one of those things where you go home and you worry about it a whole lot, and then you're just, one day you wake up and you're like, fuck it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's it. That's exactly it. You're just like, well, you accept the uncertainty as part of your life.
So for those of you who might not be following our ramblings, I think the point we're getting at is that species are a somewhat artificial construct that humans use to organize things to their own pleasure, basically. But there's obviously some merit to it, right? Because as we all know, some things are more similar to each other than others. Some things can reproduce with each other, others can't. So
yeah,
where do you guys draw the line on what is a species?
So I mean,
depends on the purpose.
Yeah, no, I think that's
entirely.
I think that's the core,
terrifying.
Right? Is that that for me? I'm comfortable with the biological species concept as a first pass. Like, it's a sensible way, and like when you're talking to lay people, as being like, "What's a species?" and like, "Oh, it's a population of organisms that can interbreed, whatever, right? Like that.
Yeah,
that
let's stop there for a second, though. So, for people who do not know, the biological species concept is exactly what Taryn just said. So, if two things can mate and produce viable offspring, then they are considered the same species.
Mm-hmm.
This is, as you said, an excellent first pass, but there's troubles with it.
How do you explain a liger?
Well,
God damn it!
Okay, so I think the second layer immediately below that is producing viable offspring, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So I think a lot of those hybrid stuff, the explanation is there that like ligers and various other like mules and stuff aren't viable. And so the parents aren't the same species.
I thought ligers can be viable. It depends on whether it's like a male or female, doesn't it? Does anybody... Is anyone up there more in ligers?
No, no. My liger knowledge is a little...
I think that the thing is they can survive one way and the other way they can't, but I don't remember.
All right, well, ligers, tigons,
let's not get into too much.
I think it might be the liger can exist and a tigon can't.
Yeah.
So the first thing is like, can they interbreed and produce offspring, mm-hmm. and then we get ligers, right? Mm-hmm. But those are not viable. They can't produce offspring.
Let me
fact
check this for us.
So okay, great. So from that we can say that lions and tigers aren't the same species because they can't produce offspring that can reproduce. But then this concept still breaks down.
Yeah. Yeah, totally, right? And I think what you were saying about purpose really gets to the core of it for me, especially when you want to deal with these irritating edge cases, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, what is a useful idea of a species to a paleontologist, especially a deep-time paleontologist, is a very different thing than what is a useful idea of a species for someone who does ecological modeling. Is a very... different and like a different idea of a species and what's useful for someone, I assume anyway, because I don't really know much about anything about it, people doing genetic, phylogenetic-y type stuff. So Nate, yeah. I actually had a question for you.
Sure.
Because I wasn't sure, you actually do a lot of species ID, right? Like this is a big part of your work is separating out and parsing out these nuanced, detail-y stuff of what species things are.
Correct. Very specific group of animals, but
yeah. So how do you like? What is the species concept to you? For me, I mean, in my work, really, what species is we abstract like over it a lot, and like to me, a species is a collection of parameters, really, right? Like that's most of my engagement with
for
it.
For you, a species is more like a functional group, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the closest thing to what a species is to me and in my work is more like the ecological species concept, right? Is a species is what it does.
Yeah.
And its identity isn't known or important. And that how you behave in the confines of the model, if you had two species that in reality were, you know, wildly different taxa, but... in the way that you're dealing with the model, have similar reproductive rates, similar trophic behavior, and you know whatever you're looking at in the model, they're going to show up and function exactly the same way in the model.
And in this way, you can end up with, like, using this classification is really, really great for doing modeling or doing, like, ecological stuff where you are concerned about, like, niches and what functions are being fulfilled and... like within a community, what functions have to be filled in order for the community to work. But
yeah,
then
exactly.
You can also end up with this weird, weird shit where, say, you end up with a marsupial wolf being classified as ecologically identical to a normal wolf or potentially a coyote. And these things are definitely wrong.
Right. Really wildly different in a lot of important biological ways, right? And there's,
exactly.
There's no hybrid marsupial placental thing happening, right?
No,
like
that's not gonna
be a thing.
To
I would be, yeah, surprised.
That's gonna haunt my dreams.
Yeah.
But yeah, getting back to your question, Taryn, about my work. One of the major goals with what I do is trying to identify fossils,
mm-hmm.
You know, based on modern taxa, based on like the existing Linnaean classification system.
Mm-hmm.
So I have you know, maybe five species is the options for this fossil species probably is. And I, you know, use basically fancy shape analysis to try to sort that unknown fossil into one of those groups. And what I find is that even with the modern groups, so the animals that are still alive today, that are of known assigned species, the species concept does kind of break down a little bit. So I...
Can you define this species concept? Or I can.
You can.
So the species concept that Nate is using in this case is the morphological species concept.
Oh, right. Sorry, I wasn't sure exactly what you... Yeah. Since that's what... Yeah. I had morphed out
primarily. Yes. No, I knew I was just, like, zooming out too far.
Yeah.
Which is the idea that if two things look the same, they are probably the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So yes, using the morphological species concept, I have these, you know, these quote species, you know, museum specimens that are assigned to these species, and I'm using them to try to classify fossils into one of these known species groups. But even these modern museum species, what I find through my analysis, when you plot them out in their shape space, what it looks like it usually ends up being somewhat of a sort of a Venn diagram shape. So you have all of these individuals of a species, of a morphological species, you know, they're generally clustering in the same area, but then they're overlapping with other species. So there are these few that are like, okay, definitely this species or definitely that species. But then there's this gray area, which really is just a pain in my ass, and it results in a lot of uncertainty with my my whole classification scheme. But
and this is kind of problematic because with paleontology, like what we're dealing with is pretty much entirely morphological species, and like what Nate is doing right now is a great kind of test of this. Because if you can't even take animals that have been, like, definitively identified to taxon and always reliably figure out what species they are just from the way that their bones look, then this can cause some issues.
Right. How can you confidently assign a fossil species to one of these groups if you can't even get all of the living ones, or recently deceased ones, rather,
into
their assigned groups?
I have another question. As you guys are both a lot more familiar with real paleontology as opposed to the hand wavy, it's a bunch of numbers about old things, way that I interact with paleontology. So when you're thinking about morphological species in the work that I guess both of you do, and you're saying, okay, these voles are species X, Y, etc. Are you using that as a proxy for the biological species concept? So when you're, because I think what you just described, if I'm understanding it correctly, you have rodent teeth, as that's most of what you work on, mm-hmm. And that you know what species they are, mm-hmm. right? And so
he had quotes going on.
Yeah, air quotes around "are," right? And so in terms of what species they are, is that the way they've been identified through the biological species concept about, like, reproductive isolation? Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
They were identified morphologically.
Mm-hmm.
And they were identified, it's much easier to identify something morphologically to species when you have the entire intact animal
mm-hmm.
than it is when you just got its bones.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So a lot of these specimens that I'm looking at, like the teeth, you know, these teeth are associated mostly with jaws, which are associated with a whole skeleton. And oftentimes with that skeleton, there's also, in the museums, a preserved skin of this animal. So they do have all these, you know, soft tissue characters, too, that they use to identify the species.
And weirdly, bacula. Even when
yeah.
they don't keep anything else, they keep penis bones. It's kind of.
I was about to say, I was like,
it's a Freudian.
I was like, leaving. It is seriously Freudian.
Reaching back into my bone terminology, I was like, isn't that a dick? Like,
yeah, that is a dick bone. Yeah. That is a dick bone. And for some reason, like, when I'm choosing my animals, like, when I'm choosing the individuals that I'm going to request for research, frequently, I'll, like, look on the thing and see what a museum has available, and it will be like pelt, skull, dick bone.
Interesting.
And that is it. And it start to wonder.
If it's not robust, you can get yourself into trouble. So,
I mean, my last trip to La Brea, there was one researcher that came in, and her whole project was just studying direwolf dick bones, and they're all just laid out there.
Is that what?
Yes, that was that Snapchat. If you guys got that Snapchat,
okay, that was hilarious.
Yes, us academics, we know of social media too. We're real people sometimes.
But what we Snapchat to each other is bins and vics of bins and
vics. Of dire wolf dicks.
Of dire wolf dicks. So if you were wondering. No.
But yeah, so getting back to your question, your point again, Taryn, weaving back to the main topic. So yeah, a lot of these characters in the literature, in the scientific literature, for how to identify these different taxa, a lot of it is soft tissue. So every once in a while you get lucky and there's this nice paper to follow on, these morphological characters to identify recent taxa. Yeah. Obviously, going deeper in time, all they have is bone morphology to go off of. But for a lot of animals that are still alive today, there's all these characters. It's either differences in like coat pattern, or maybe it's like ear length or tail length, and even like things like certain dimensions of like a complete skull, which oftentimes in the fossil record, you can get jaws tend to preserve fairly well, but whole skulls, brain cases are very thin, they shatter easily. You hardly ever get a 3D skull. Like that's like hitting basically the lottery for for fossils. So unfortunately, a lot of those existing morphological characters are useless from a deep time perspective.
And we also have less and less context going into deep time. So dealing with taxa that we still have members of around today, we can be like, okay, so all of these species or things that we think are species that we're looking at in the fossil record, we're looking at bones of, don't exist anymore. But we know that in the taxa that still exist or the species that still exist that are related to this group, that this is the amount of kind of physical variation between species. Whereas the further back in time, the less context you have for that.
Yeah.
Which means the further back in time, the sketchier our definitions of species get, but also the broader they get. We end up including lots and lots of things together as a species that are probably not, because we just don't know.
Yeah.
And this also gets interesting, because then a lot of what you're saying from a paleontological point of view gets down to the real question, which is, what are you trying to achieve when you're defining a species, since it doesn't exactly exist?
Right, exactly.
And I guess from here, do you guys want to talk about the usefulness of defining it in different ways next, or why species don't actually totally exist?
Before we get to that, I would like to cycle back to the liger.
Yeah.
So I have information now.
Yeah.
And, so according to the interweb, though many hybrid animals are infertile, ligers and tigons are not.
Whoa.
Interesting. They are perfectly capable of breeding and producing ligons, ligers, and other such amalgamations.
Oh my goodness.
Further complicating our species concept.
There we go. And this is why it's Lytigons and Tyligers, every single species in the genus Canis, that is the wolf and dog genus, illustrate to us why the biological species concept doesn't always work.
That's especially interesting to me, because I've been trying to figure out the Pleistocene distribution of tigers, and I haven't been able to find a good map of that. I haven't been able to find a good map, and it seems like for the most part, lions and tigers don't really have a lot of range overlap historically, even though you get lions in Siberia and India. I mean, there must have been some, but I wonder if that's like social differences in social dynamics or interbreeding or what's going on there. That's really wacky, though.
Well, it could be like a polar bear thing, kind of thing. Where, like, you know, polar bears and grizzly bears interbreed only when they're super, super stressed.
Yeah.
But not
otherwise. Desperate times call for desperate measures.
Exactly. Yeah. When your ice caps are melting.
Yeah, yeah.
Those grizzly bears start looking awful nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, most ligers and taigons are only bred in like, captivity, right? It's not like something
no.
that but cause, a lot. No, because the modern ranges are super
don't
different.
Meet anymore.
And so, the, like, the population, there's a small population of lions left in India,
mm-hmm.
And they have tigers in India, and that's the only modern range overlap that they mm-hmm. have.
And do they actually reproduce?
I have no idea. I doubt it, but the modern population of lions, anyway, I mean, but tigers as
the
well,
modern population,
so small that...
Exactly.
Right, they're having a hard enough time.
They may not even encounter each other right now.
Yeah, I don't know if they're any even coexisting in the same habitats right now, but...
Because even the tiger habitats in India are super dispersed from each other. And I have no idea where the lions in India actually live.
They, last time they checked, they were in the Gir Forest, but they got moved around a bit, and so it's a really small population. Mm. Not a lot of Asian lions getting around, but I mean, it wasn't that long ago that lions were pretty much everywhere. So
yeah,
at the very least, in Siberia and North China, you'd have range overlap.
By the way, guys, lions used to be super common.
Yeah, like everywhere common,
and even occurred in North America.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Up until about 11,000 years ago.
North America, Europe, Russia, all of Africa, just about.
Mm-hmm.
Not Australia, but...
Well...
Yeah, I just have to be careful about... I said they were everywhere, but they weren't everywhere. They were just in a lot of places.
They were broadly distributed.
Whenever we say everywhere and we're talking about species or taxa of animals, we mean everywhere but Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Unless...
Yeah. Everywhere
someday
but Australia.
We'll have a conversation just about Australia.
Yeah. 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 Place is wacky.
Yeah, it is.
Madagascar, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Someday we will have a conversation just about Australia and Madagascar.
Yeah.
First, we need a foundational conversation in plate tectonics.
Ooh, we need Rob for that one. Doesn't he?
Madagascar?
Yeah.
Okay.
He works
for
on the Madagascar stuff.
Plate
right?
tectonics.
No.
Why? He's not going to know anything about that.
And island ecology and evolutionary dynamics is really interesting, too.
Yeah, it is.
And Australia and Madagascar both lean to that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. All of those are going on the list.
So okay. So your original, you were suggesting one of two paths, and then Nate was like, no, secret third path, and now I don't remember what the original two paths
it's
suggestion.
It's just tradition.
Let's see. Oh, path number one was... why we use... Actually, no. They make sense in relation to each other. Path number one is why species don't actually exist.
Mm.
And that's the one we need to go down first. And number two is why we need different species concepts.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
But we need different species concepts because we're approximating something that doesn't technically exist. So we should probably talk about the first one first.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the first one was species concepts, right? Different species concepts.
No,
that's the second one.
That's the second one.
Oh, God.
Nate.
Okay.
Making everything so hard, Nate.
First one is why species don't actually exist. Like, why species itself is a construct.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we've already discussed that. Right, in some detail?
Some.
Not biologically.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Like, I think we could discuss it a little bit more explicitly, and that would probably be a nice thing
mm-hmm.
for our many non-biologist listeners who, in theory, exist. So I was thinking, like, and jump in here whenever you guys feel like. So, we discussed why several concepts of species break down already, like why the biological species concept doesn't always work, because there's too many exceptions. So we'll get back in a moment to why we try to define things. But, so yeah, the trouble is that species don't actually totally exist. It's a thing that we define to make our lives easier so we can categorize animals so we can, well, so we can deal with them. So we can look at a thing and be like, that thing is a polar bear. That thing is a dog. That thing is a linseng.
Yes.
The linseng doesn't care.
Yes. Always props for a linseng reference. Yeah.
Well, always Bavarians.
Well done.
Thank you.
It's just human nature to categorize something in a way that is understandable to us.
No. You know?
Yeah. I think it's really interesting because it's kind of like, it's that kind of, in some ways it gets to the core of why I think science is so important and taking a scientific perspective is because species is something that's so intuitive and so natural to the human scale of experience. Where the way we're like, you know, we live for, I don't know, like 50, 60 years if we're lucky, and we dick around and interact with organisms in the environment, and, you know, we see dogs and we see pigeons, and if you are not living in a city, you see all sorts of other things as well, right? But in a way where it's obvious that even if you aren't super familiar with plant biology, that there are a bunch of different types of plants. And that to understand why things are so much more fluid and sketchy than that, as you're saying, requires you to step back in ways and think in ways that are not really natural to the human scale of experience, I think.
Yeah.
And you need kind of special training and special tools for doing that properly.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what's so interesting is, like, we know intuitively what a species is, at least in general. Like, humans have a good working definition of a species. So if you don't have to define it, if you can just point to two things and be like, are those two things the same kind of thing?
Yeah.
You can be like, yes, or you can be like, no. And I think that exactly like you were saying, a lot of the trouble with science is that once you start digging into things a bit more, figuring out exactly what makes, like, if you're going to define what makes those two things the same thing,
mm-hmm.
suddenly your life gets a whole lot harder than just looking at them and being like, why yes, or why no? And this is why we have a lot of different definitions, because, like, animals are always evolving. They're constantly evolving. We're evolving, everything around us is evolving. I didn't mean just animals, like, everything. Everything that is alive is constantly evolving.
Not like Pokemon.
Slowly. That's right. Slowly, over there. Many generations. Damn it. Darwinian evolution. Yeah. Mm.
God, we should have a plant biologist here when we're talking about this stuff. At least somebody who does something with plants.
Sorry, guys. Yeah, yeah. We are super animal-centric, particularly mammal-centric.
Yeah.
We will have other people talking about other things also at some point. At this point, even Kinsey would be adding a whole lot of variation.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. We're so biased right now.
That's okay. That's okay. We'll throw in some plant bones.
Organisms are always evolving. And because of that, like, two things that used to be the same thing and are slowly becoming different things can be at absolutely any stage whatsoever of becoming different things when we decide to observe them.
Yeah.
Also, two things that have been two different things for a while can come back together and decide that they want to be the same thing after all. They've been kind of lonely without each other or whatever. And that makes it really, really messy. Because when you're looking at the overview of a thing, again, it's, like, super easy to define what that thing is. But when you start looking at the edges, the boundaries between those things, the edges are super fuzzy. And it starts to get really, really difficult to tell exactly what makes one species different from another species, especially when you want to sum it up, like, consistently across lots of different things.
Hence why we have created subspecies.
Yes.
That's the real solution to this problem, is finer and finer scales of taxa.
And subgenera. Yes! On the other end of this blurred sort of amalgamation.
Yes. Finer and finer definition. And then on top of it, two things that are biologically two different species, like, can no longer interbreed, but are very recently related to each other, might be doing ecologically exactly the same thing. Yeah. And they might be different species now because of genetic drift. Basically because of random mutation and separation in their populations for a while. But two things that are still... Is that not...
No. I was just... I want to mention something when you're done. But just have an example. That's good.
And then two things that are still the same species might be fulfilling wildly different ecological functions, even though they can still interbreed with each other, and this shit happens. So then, like, talking about why we want to try to define this thing becomes really important to deciding how we want to define it.
Just what you were describing reminded me of a paper that I read years ago that's such a good example of how you can have these weird drift events that where the you now have two, according to the biological species definition, two different species that actually have exactly the same ecology other than their reproductive dynamics. And it's also one of my favorite alliterations, is that there's a paper on the speciation of sinistral snails in sympatry with snail-eating snakes. And so what it was is there's these snails where their shells are normally curved to the right or like spiral to the right.
Yeah.
And they can have some weird genetic thing happen where they curl to the left instead.
So it's like
and
clockwise,
then,
counterclockwise.
Yeah.
It's like sinistral and then whatever the option is. Anyways, it doesn't matter. They curve one way and the other.
Yeah.
But they can't sex good anymore once that happens. So they're complete. They live in the same environment, and they're now completely reproductively isolated.
Yeah.
And they're hermaphroditic, so it shouldn't be that hard for them.
But no, that's no, it's something. It's something about how the shells line up. It's something about how the shells line up. They can't sex good
like
anymore.
Like they curve one way.
Yeah.
So they both curve the same way.
Yeah.
And then they don't both curve the same way anymore. So they're just like
one hangs to the right, one hangs to the left.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But in a way that's more severe than
mechanical
you might find in human populations.
issues.
But what happens is there are these snail-eating snakes that exist in this environment that have like something about the morphology of their jaws that's really dialed into eating the common form of these snails.
Oh, yeah,
and so there's actually like a fitness advantage to having this reproductive isolation, and it happens enough that it's like its own new species, biological species of that. But ecologically, they're exactly the same, and it happens just with this tiny, immediate little genetic event. And I mostly just like it for the alliteration.
That is so cool.
But it's pretty rad.
Also, the alliteration is great.
That's a wild tangent, but here we are. I think this issue of what, like, the utility of species definitions is really interesting. It's something that sort of, hopefully later in my PhD research, what I really want to answer questions about is this conservation approach that's really about making use of an ecological species definition.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's this... this idea of rewilding and using ecological circuits, right? You know, we live in this wildly defaunated time where, especially for megafauna and large animals that don't even necessarily meet the megafauna criteria.
Yeah, our megafauna are so sad now.
Yeah, we live in this...
Coyote megafauna.
Exactly. This weird...
What was meso-predators, now apex.
and so, exploring this idea of... Okay, even if the genetic identity of these species is substantially different in some cases, if their trophic and ecological behavior is similar enough, we can, you know, through the ecological species definition, basically, create, introduce species that are foreign but fill a vacant ecological niche to restore some function or community dynamics that we're trying to rebuild. And I find this compelling. I think there's a lot of reason to be concerned and to approach this sort of thing very carefully. And maybe it's just my bias from when I do 90% of my research, what a species genetic identity is doesn't fucking matter anyway, because it's just a collection of behavior as numbers and like network interactions for me. That approaching in this way and thinking about it this way makes a lot of natural sense. And particularly spending time looking at the Pleistocene fossil record and realizing how sad the current state of affairs is. And so for me, I think when I first learned about the ecological species definition, it seemed like, okay, yeah, I can see like what they mean, but I don't understand what utility it might have.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're reaching a time now where there is actually some real conservation utility to being like, you know, filling in a few gaps here and there with close relatives or something that functions trophically or ecologically very similarly can actually be of a lot of use.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, and this is what's where it gets super, super interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, from conservation biology perspective, this is a totally, completely reasonable thing to do. Because when the goal becomes to preserve functions in order to preserve ecosystems overall, then this is something that makes a hell of a lot of sense, and not just makes sense, but is, like, totally critical.
Yeah,
because when things go extinct, and sometimes they can't be replaced with something that currently exists, and sometimes they can be replaced with a thing that currently exists, but it's from, like, a totally different area, like physically removed, but environmentally exactly the same.
Right.
And from the perspective of needing to fulfill functions in order to keep, like, the other things in that place stable,
mm-hmm.
I think it's an amazing idea.
Yeah.
And then from, like, other perspectives, though, from, like, an evolutionary perspective, it gets so hairy.
Yeah, fair enough.
The ecological spare tire. It might not match all the others, but it'll keep your car running.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I think that's a really good analogy, too, right? Because, or metaphor, because, you know, and I think conservation is slowly moving in this direction, but that we have to focus on the fact that keeping the car running is what is most important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Having all of the original tires is fucking great. Yeah. And if we can do that, fantastic. But at the end of the day, the goal has to be a systems focused, keep the car running.
Exactly.
Especially at the rate in which our car is degrading. And yes, that is a climate change reference.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's not even just climate change. It's lots of stuff.
Right.
Climate change is just the biggest one of the...
Yeah. And
anthropogenic encroachment.
Yeah.
Would be the broader definition.
But yeah, I think... So for me, in terms of looking at species definitions and what are they for, right? Like, what's the utility of having 40 different ways of thinking about what a species is when we're cutting down fine. For me, that's my favorite, most important, most practical. What is the ecological species definition for?
Yeah.
It's for keeping the car running. I mean, it's for, like, a lot of stuff in modeling and stuff too, right? But that's for all 12 of us who do ecological modeling in that way. But from, like, an applied conservation perspective, an ecological species concept, I think, is really important. It's not like, oh yeah, so that means that a like Iberian lynx and a Canada lynx are exactly the same thing. That's not the point. It's just that they may keep the car running in the same way.
Exactly.
Or in a close enough way that the overall qualitative system dynamics and
keep the system not collapsing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
Definition.
Iberian lynx in Eurasia is ideal, but if Iberian lynx is no longer an option or becomes not feasible...
Yeah, we're not far off.
Then, we're not far off, and we need to just go with what we have.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than allowing everything to collapse.
Yeah.
But then there's also species whose, like... This doesn't mean... This can make it sound like no individual species is important.
But I think even the biological species concept is important to conservation.
Oh yeah.
Because
I think it's one of the most important.
Exactly.
Right?
I think the biological species concept might be the most important.
How do you define what you're saving in policy if you don't have this biological species concept?
Exactly.
Sure.
And I think that's the thing, is it's so much more easier, like vastly easier, to maintain an intact system than it is to start replacing pieces.
Yeah.
Because you never know when when you're going to run into a situation when the Iberian lynx and the Canadian lynx are not quite as close as what you thought they were.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you're kind of fucked.
Yeah.
Also, there are, like, and we could debate about the usefulness of this concept if you guys wanted to. There's keystone species, which people do argue a lot about the validity of, but I think to some extent, at least, they are valid, where basically the idea is that there are certain species that are strong drivers of an ecosystem that are much, much harder to replace than other species, especially since we are already basically species deficient since the Pleistocene.
Yep.
So, for example, things like elephants are major ecosystem drivers and extremely difficult to replace. So if elephants go extinct, the environments they live in are going to look crazy different from what they do, and there's not a damn thing we can do about it because we can't replace them with anything. Or like sea otters, where the environments, because of the way that sea otters interact with their prey, the environments that have sea otters look very different from the environments that do not have sea otters and are much more biodiverse.
Yeah.
And even the disappearance of large carnivores has cascade effects. Yeah,
huge difference.
So there's this thing going on in a lot of systems. It's called mesopredator release. And what this is with the absence of these, you know, large, you know, big bad carnivores like lions and stuff like that.
Lions and tigers and bears. Oh,
yeah,
why?
Or if we want to go back to the Pleistocene, you know, like saber-tooths and dire wolves and all that cool stuff. You know, with the absence of all of, you know, that's going too far back. Let's just stick with it. with the absence of these larger carnivores, all these smaller things, you know, like raccoon and, you know, coyote-sized animals, there's nothing controlling them anymore. They're not intimidated by anything. They're breeding, they're eating, and this has, you know, potentially catastrophic effects on wildlife when these sort of mid-sized carnivores that were kept in check before, cats, you know, where cats have an awful effect on birds in a lot of areas. That's not necessarily just because of large carnivore release. It's a lot of human, breeding and stuff. But anyway,
and then
the point remains. Or, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and then also, like, populations of relatively large herbivores also end up being out of check. Like, when you remove wolves from a place, the deer populations skyrocket. And having huge deer populations is not actually a great thing, because they eat everything. And then you don't have small trees anymore. And if you don't have small trees anymore, eventually you don't have big trees anymore. And then the deer all die because they've eaten everything and they starve to death.
Cool.
Yeah. Real exciting.
Yeah.
So if any of you out there have studied in, like, some high school class or something, like the lynx-rabbit dynamic, where lynx and rabbit populations cycle together, but kind of set apart from each other, this is that thing. And then if you remove a ton of lynx, you get a crazy ton of rabbits and then a huge crash. And this can have very far-reaching effects on an ecosystem.
Predator-prey dynamics.
Yeah.
Take-home message is, not all species are created equal as far as their function in the system goes. The removal of some species has more catastrophic effects than others. The problem is, a lot of times we don't know what species in which area will have a positive or negative effect. Like, is the introduction of this species going to be a good thing or a bad thing? Is the removal of this one going to be good or bad? It gets very complex, and people like Taryn sometimes spend their whole careers trying to...
That's what modeling's for.
Model and predict these things, and you know, probably to very...
Doing this shit in real life is too expensive. So you do it with math. I think
I like the real life.
I think the... the keystone stuff is really interesting. But the trouble I have is, like, the extreme cases are obvious, and I'm comfortable with that, but I just don't... Mm-hmm. I've never seen anything compelling of, like, this is where we draw the line. Because it's about, if I understand correctly, generally the designation is about having an impact on the overall structure of the ecosystem well beyond what your abundance might suggest, right?
Yeah.
And so figuring out, like, where's that line? I'm not like, oh, keystone species don't exist. I'm not in that camp. but I don't know where to draw that line, and that does something itchy in my brain of like where the cutoff is.
It's exactly the same as what is a species.
Yeah, fair enough.
There's not a firm cutoff, and the definition of a keystone species can range from like the classic definition of a species whose effect is far greater than the proportion of individuals in the population to a somewhat looser thing where just the effect of the species is far greater on the environment than what one would expect given the proportion of species.
I think what might really be happening to me is that I see people abusing the term in media all the time.
They do.
And so that I've just like stopped engaging.
This is where this is where actual science and conservation sometimes conflict. The thing is that you can get a lot of attention saying that something is a keystone species, and you can leverage that to then protect an entire environment. Where if you say, oh, this cute thing is super, super important and is like declining right now, and the entire ecosystem maybe is important, but you can't get the entire ecosystem protected by just being like, this place is cool.
You can get that animal
protected, and it protects the whole place.
Yeah.
And thus it's really badly abused.
That's so backwards.
Conflict, I guess, or is it? Because you know, if you don't know which species being removed from a system are going to have a catastrophic effect on it, you know, is it necessarily bad to sort of over push this agenda to save as many species as possible?
I think probably nobody in this room thinks that there's such a thing as over pushing at all.
No, but that makes sense.
We might be a little biased there, but
right. But this is a fine line to walk because then there's also just like an overall right now sort of distrust in scientists in general, and you know, is this going to?
I don't think that is a place that contributes to distrust in scientists, though.
Conservation.
No, abuse of the keystone species.
Oh, okay.
Conservation, definitely.
Yeah, no. I think abusing science jargon interferes with the trust between scientists and science communicators more than it does between science communicators and the public.
Exactly. I think ultimately it has a relationship because abusing that language, like science communicators abusing that language, makes scientists trust everybody else less. And we already don't trust everybody else very much. And then when we feel pushed away, we're like, we're not going to try to talk to you folks because you people clearly don't understand and are choosing to not understand. So we're just not going to try to talk to you anymore, which ultimately is a big problem for people understanding and trusting science.
Yeah.
But I think it's an indirect relationship.
I think especially for people like us who, we all work in ecology in one way or another. And are interested in conservation, as I've never met an ecologist who wasn't at least tangentially interested in conservation.
That would be so hard, kind of fucked up.
It would be. I know that they exist.
Never mind. That would be real fucked up.
I know that they exist in some capacity. I just haven't met them. But I think it's more difficult. I think there are parts of science where people feel comfortable kind of taking refuge, right? Like really buying into the ivory tower stuff and being like, oh yeah, we just do science, and it's not. I'm not required to trust or engage the public, but I think for people in ecology specifically, lots of other places too, and just people as individuals, but for ecology as a discipline, it's so tied to the material outcomes of what's happening in the real world that it's hard for us to just be like, accept distrust or accept a lack of communication, because like,
I think
watching everything burn to the ground kind of sucks in my experience, so.
Exactly, I think you're completely right. We get we study ecology because we like living things and we like intact ecosystems and we enjoy the things that those things have to offer to the world.
Ecosystem services.
Since that's why we do what we do, it's almost impossible to not be super invested in the outcomes.
Yeah, for sure. Right.
And there's a lot of research done that shows that, like, having access to nature, you know, actually decreases stress, like, increases, yeah. like, sleep efficiency, and basically and all these good empathy. Things. Yeah, yeah. All these generally good things for people, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interacting with other natural things is... Oh, sorry. Momentary distraction here. yeah, it's an overall good thing, you know? And it's something that we maybe take for granted, but an important thing that we need to preserve as best we can.
So, turning back to species concept a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I guess I don't talk much about the biological species concept because I think it's, for me, it's largely just intuitive, and I understand why that's most important to most people. Mm-hmm. But the use of the morphological species concept in paleontology is kind of, I said like eight things are really interesting, but. Science, so everything's really interesting.
It's not like if we have other options, we'd probably explore.
Right,
but in deep time, that's really all you have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So beyond just the fact that it's what you have, mm-hmm. what do you guys think is the strong utility of the morphological species concept? Like, what do you really get out of that?
Well, I mean, in general,
lots of things
that are closely related generally share a likeness mm-hmm. in a very very general sense. There is, of course, convergent evolution, where things that are not so closely related can share similar morphological features that help them interact with their environments, which mm-hmm. may be similar, even if they don't share close ancestry.
Right.
So it's not perfect. But, you know, in general, like, a human skull and another human skull will look more similar to each other than they will to any other animal.
In your experience with... is convergent evolution something that throws off or you have to worry about actively in your species ID?
In my experience, so I've only worked with, you know, I sort of obsess over a few taxa. I don't do like these, you know, very broad morphological analyses, which some people do, and I'm sure it's more of an issue there.
Lord Rodentia.
Convergent evolution is really cool. It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's an awesome example of evolution. In my experience, it's not super common. It's not something you have to worry about all the time.
Right.
Like, there's all these, you know, classic examples of it, you know, like bat wings and
right.
so on and so forth.
It's always it seemed to me as something that shows up more on this like functional trait level,
exactly,
than on this like species ID level. Was sort of my feel, but it's really not my area.
Yeah,
Yeah. That is accurate. Like, you're never going to get a bird wing that looks like a bat wing, and you're not going to be able right. to tell the difference.
Yeah.
In general, convergent evolution is not a thing you have to worry about mistaking two completely different, or two species of completely different origin with each other, because there's always going to be tells.
Right.
Bones are super complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And... musculature and tendons and shit like that is super complicated and varies between taxa more than most people give it credit for.
Right.
Which means that there's always going to be some sign that these things, and probably far more sign that these things are not related to each other closely than sign that they are closely related to each other when they're reaching the same morphological conclusion from two completely different directions.
Right.
If they are close taxa, like if you have, say, a family, and then you have two different genera being the plural of genus, and you have two different genera, and then a single species within each genus that has come upon the same ecological solution to survival and thus the same morphological solution,
mm-hmm.
you might have a bit more trouble telling that they're not sister species, but that's kind of the exception to that. And still, those things are pretty closely related to each other.
Right.
They're in a different genus, but that's not really all that far.
Mm. Yeah, the only example I can think of off the top of my head... like in my day-to-day research where I have this case of morphological convergence that has sort of been detrimental to my analysis. not super detrimental, but just enough to be annoying.
Yeah.
is actually pocket gophers and kangaroo rats.
Really?
Weird.
These are two, you know, rodent species. Well, genera, I guess. Pocket gophers being genus Thamomys, kangaroo rats being genus Diplodomys. But they're in different families. Very, you know, so okay. They're rodents. They're both rodents, but as far as rodents go, fairly different.
Yeah.
You know, one's a gopher, the other kangaroo rat.
But it's primarily their teeth, obvious. Right?
Yes. And so it's certain
only looking
elements.
At one trait.
Right. If you're going to look at their whole skulls, you would never confuse them.
Yeah.
But in the fossil
only
record, a lot
an
of
idiot
times...
would get confused about the skull difference between the skull of a pocket gopher and a kangaroo rat.
Well,
pathetic.
Kangaroo rats have these freakishly large, like, tympanic areas that just they're
ear bones.
Yeah, sorry, ear bones. But if you know, a lot of times with fossils, you are dealing with isolated elements,
yeah.
And so mm-hmm. getting back to this, it can be an issue in with certain features, you know.
So Nate works with loose teeth mostly, mm-hmm. and loose teeth are super common.
Mm-hmm. And normally, teeth
also
are like the easiest thing. Yeah, so they're usually like one of the best characters in as far as isolated elements go to differentiate.
They're still teeth.
Animals. They are teeth, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, teeth are, I think, evolution selects teeth faster than a lot of other elements to change, mm-hmm. even at the species level, just based on slight variations in, you know, your feeding ecology and stuff like that. And therefore,
business happens with the teeth.
Yeah, right, you know. And in order to stay alive, you got to eat. And anytime you eat something a little different, you know, that's going to rapidly affect the morphology of your tooth. So usually that is a good way to differentiate species.
Work.
Yeah, there's lots of it. There's lots of exceptions.
I'm just being...
But and the one exception that I deal with on a day-to-day basis is these peg-like teeth of kangaroo rats and pocket gophers that at an initial glance can look very similar. They can be very difficult to tell apart. There is like a without getting into too much minutia here.
Right.
The pocket gopher tooth is somewhat more teardrop shaped usually, and the kangaroo rat tooth is generally more oval shaped. And for adult individuals, anyone who's like looked at them a few times can probably differentiate them without too much difficulty. The problem is when you're dealing with different ontogenetic stages, so different growth stages. So like going from like a baby to, you know, an angsty teenager to an adult to a crotchety old almost dead rodent. You know, there's going to be differences in shape. And the problem is with these younger stages of rodents, the pocket gopher and kangaroo rat teeth are almost indistinguishable. They have this sort of weird horseshoe, not quite fully developed tooth morphology. And to this day, if it's a juvenile specimen, I cannot differentiate between the two of them. So without drawing out too far here on this, yes, there are examples.
Right.
They're not super common, but... Yeah, convergence is definitely a thing that happens sometimes, and it's a challenge you just have to deal with.
Yeah, with isolated elements,
with,
huge issue.
So using a morphological species definition kind of sits between a genetic or biological definition and an ecological definition, right? Like, gives you kind of information about both to one extent, because there's a lot of stuff about there's a lot of stuff about function in there, and there's, you know, with caveats, information about biological relatedness and stuff in there too. Especially if, for the most part, you can ID when something is a weird convergence going on.
Especially if you're dealing with an extinct animal. You can't say for certain whether these two extinct morphological species are breeding or not, you know?
Yeah. Sounds very rare fossil sites.
where you catch them in the deed,
Or all of the human Neanderthal cross fossils folks ignored for years.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize there was like good cross fossils. I knew it's like half Neanderthal or whatever. But
Jessica is apparently like point or two variants out of like 400 more.
Right. Just enough to beat you. That's the important part. I didn't realize there was like interesting cross fossils.
There are actually several pretty good human Neanderthal cross fossils.
And I'm going to cut this off here. We'll have a proper conversation about human relatives and ancestors for you guys sometime soon. And once again, you've been listening to Danon, Nate, and Taryn on the Quest Podcast. If you would like to know more about the Quest podcast or know more about QuestX and our other activities, please visit www.questx.net. Our website is currently in process, Thank you for your patience. And thanks for listening.